And that kind of criticism doesn't show familiarity with the secular allusions to Jesus in ancient literature. Let me give you just a few examples. There was a Roman historian by the name of Tacitus. Want me to spell that for you? T-A-C-I-T-U-S, Tacitus. And in his Annals, Book 15, Section 44, he refers to a man by the name of Christus, who he said suffered the extreme penalty at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. The Jewish historian Josephus, in his Antiquities, Book 20, Section 9, refers to James, the brother of Jesus, who is called the Christ. And so when unbelieving scholars, or worse, students at the university will throw things out like, well, we don't really have any historical reason to believe that there was a Jesus at all. Not only are they prejudicially dismissing the Bible as a source of information, even on their own terms. I mean, they may want to explain away the supernatural about Jesus and so forth, but this is a source of some kind of information that has to be dealt with. And they don't deal with, I mean, they haven't read in the field. If they did, they'd know that there are allusions to Jesus, even in secular literature. There was a time when critics of the Old Testament ridiculed it for mentioning a tribe of people known as the Hittites. At that time, the Hittites were unknown outside of the Bible. That is, the Bible talked about the Hittites, but at that point, scholars didn't have any other information except the Bible about the Hittites. And believe it or not, I can give you the books, if you go to a library that has books, I can show you books where the Bible was ridiculed for mentioning the Hittites. We all know there were no Hittites, but the Bible makes up this term Hittites and uses it. Such presumed flaws in the biblical record were taken as rendering it worthless as a historical document until Hittite artifacts and monuments began to be discovered around Carchemish by archaeologists beginning in the year 1871. The Hittite civilization is today one of the best-known cultures of the ancient world. And yet prior to 1871, the Bible was ridiculed for its historical inaccuracy in speaking of this unknown tribe, the Hittites. Archaeology has over and over and over again proven to be the enemy of Bible critics because it unearths their negative prejudices and repeatedly confirms the accuracy of the scriptures in the particulars of history. H.M. Orlinsky once wrote, and I quote him, "More and more, the older view that the biblical data were suspect and even likely to be false unless corroborated by extra-biblical facts is giving way to one which holds that by and large the biblical accounts are more likely to be true than false." Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not real proud of somebody who says the Bible is more likely to be true than false. That's not a Christian opinion, and I'm going to do better than that when we defend the faith. But what I'm saying is when unbelievers say, oh, you can't trust, you know, the history, Hittites, historical Jesus, and so forth, then it realizes that even unbelieving scholars will tell you other than that. Even as unsympathetic an umpire as Time magazine, in a lead article back in 1977 entitled "How True is the Bible?" had to admit, and I'm quoting, well, this is a scholarly source, huh? Time magazine tells us, that was tongue-in-cheek for those of you who didn't miss it, "After more than two centuries of facing the heaviest scientific guns that could be brought to bear, the Bible has survived and is perhaps the better for the siege. Even on the critics' own terms, historical fact, the scriptures seem more acceptable now than they did when the rationalists began the attack." Now, I'm only trying to make one very simple point here, and that's that you must be prepared to expose the conjecture and the prejudice of unbelievers. They don't always come out and say, oh, I haven't read this, I haven't done the research, and it's just my opinion. But they'll throw this conjecture out. Well, you can't trust the text of the Bible. We don't even know that Jesus existed. Or you can't count on the Bible to be accurate historically. You need to be able to embarrass the unbeliever when he uses arbitrary and ignorant conjectures in the place of evidence and reasoning. We have to point out how unreasonable it is to be prejudiced in any area, but especially in an area that has to do with eternal consequences. The more people come to know about the facts or the details of the text of the Bible or the historical reports of the Bible, the more they come to know about that, the less likely they will be to dismiss the book out of hand. I'm not saying that the more they come to know, the more likely it is they'll come to be Christians. That's a much different matter. What I'm saying is, even in the field of secular scholarship, it's the least well-read that have strong prejudices against the accuracy of the text or the history of the Bible. People who aren't even Christians will say, well, in general, the Bible has fared pretty well given the fact that everybody's gunning for it. Okay, so examples of arbitrariness: mere opinion. Secondly, relativism. Thirdly, ignorant conjecture. And then fourthly, as a form of arbitrariness, unargued bias. Even if enough external corroborating evidence were available from textual criticism and from archaeology and from the related sciences such as history and linguistics and so forth, even if we had enough evidence to deal with all of the historical points in the Bible, people would be quick to point out to us that the most important features of the biblical narrative are not simply the accounts of the Hittites or of military battles and migrations and other sorts of things there, but rather the accounts in the Bible of things like floating axe heads and fiery chariots and water being turned to wine and virgin birth and resurrection. When unbelievers read of the miraculous accounts in the Bible, their first inclination is to say that such things cannot happen, and thus they disbelieve the written report of them. They'll say things like, we all know that people can't walk on water, and so the story of Jesus walking in the water must be fabricated. And I think all of you are familiar enough with that line of reasoning that you may easily be drawn into it when somebody talks about the Bible. I think we use the same line of reasoning when we're standing at the checkout counter at the supermarket. I don't know where you all live, but back in Southern California, the land of fruits and nuts, at our checkout counters, we have all these tabloid newspapers. Do you have that too? You know, girl gives birth to her own father. Headlines. Fantastic tabloid headlines, you know. Alien comes down, you know, and marries Julia Roberts or something. No, that's not an alien. That's a country and western singer. I'm sorry. But they have things like that. And the implicit argument that we would use is, well, things like that are impossible, and so they could not have occurred. And unbelievers will dismiss in advance the possibility of the miraculous events reported in the Bible because they use an unspoken premise. They cast a doubtful eye upon the biblical narrative, saying, since the Bible says Jesus rose from the dead, and yet we know the dead do not rise, therefore the Bible is wrong. And unbelievers easily assume that people who live in the enlightened, scientific 20th century cannot accept that kind of superstitious, bogus stuff. That's myth. That's fairy tale, they'll say. After all, we use refrigerators. We use computers today. Jesus couldn't have risen from the dead. But now, if they are being rational when they argue in this way, if they're going to be fully rational, unbelievers who doubt the biblical narrative with respect to miracles have to pause and recognize and scrutinize their controlling assumptions. Okay, and that's why I'm saying when you do that, you're going to find, lo and behold, there's an unargued bias in this argument that has to be exposed. And that unspoken assumption is, we know that miracles are impossible. To which you need to say, we know that? Now, we're going beyond mere opinion. It's your opinion miracles are impossible. You know that miracles are impossible. How much would a person have to know, how much information would a person have to have taken in about the natural world to say that miracles are impossible? notice, not unlikely or rare, but impossible. And anyone figure this out? It's not a really tough thing logically. How much would you have to know about the natural world to dismiss the possibility of miracles? You'd have to know everything, wouldn't you? You'd have to know every fact of science, every conceivable fact of science. And say, okay, I've looked at all of them, and I now know that there's just no room for the miraculous here. And so an unbeliever, without even arguing the case, dismisses miracles as impossible. You need to point out that is being arbitrary. Now, it would be a very interesting argument for somebody to show the impossibility of miracles. You know, and I don't want to say it's impossible that somebody would try that. But you know, the vast majority of people you talk to, even at the university level, the vast majority of professors, are not going to bother to argue the impossibility of miracles. They're just going to what? Take it for granted. That's a bias. Rational people don't just take things for granted. They don't just say, well, I don't want to think this universe is capable of producing miraculous events, and so I'll just not interpret anything as miraculous. Unbelievers feel that they know that such events cannot take place because they have a scientific outlook, and they're convinced that all of nature operates in a predictable and a law-like fashion. And so you need to say, and how do you know that all of nature operates in a predictable law-like fashion? The answer will come back, because the portion of nature that I'm familiar with does. Okay. Let me go over that again, because you should be, at this point, ready to pounce on that argument. So, okay. How do you know that all of nature operates in a predictable law-like fashion? The answer is because in all of my experience, nature has operated in a predictable law-like fashion. Yes, but not all of nature is contained in the sum of nature, the little bit of nature that you've experienced. In logic, what do we call that? Krista, you know the answer to this? That's right. Hasty generalization. In logic, that is taking a little bit of evidence and then universalizing the evidence. A person hasn't got a good argument to say, well, it's always been predictable. And then if you point that out to unbelievers, what they're going to tell you, I love this, they'll say, oh, well, yeah, that's right. I don't know that all of nature is like that, but miracles would run counter to the regularities in my experience. They would not be predictable given the world that I know, and so they're really extraordinary then. If there are miracles, they would be really extraordinary. And you want to go, duh, yeah. Isn't that the point? We wouldn't call them miracles if they weren't extraordinary. Okay, now an unbeliever who hears that and realizes, you know, I've really got a bias here that I've been pushing, you know, in my argument. And I have no argument, no logically sound argument for that bias, is going to have to fall back then on not allowing for any possibility of miracles because he believes that causality operates in the universe. In fact, everything that is to be explained, according to the unbeliever, if you wish to be scientific, if you wish to be rational, if you wish to be modern and enlightened, must be explained in a causal fashion. We're not just talking about what causes malaria here. We're not just talking about how to build a bridge or send a rocket to the moon. We want to explain human behavior in causal terms as well. Anything that happens must have some kind of natural causal explanation for it. Okay, for the time being, let's assume that the unbeliever is going to be able to rule out miracles as soon as he arrives at a foundation for causality. Okay, we say, okay, yes, that's true. If everything operates in a causal fashion, then we aren't going to have any extraordinary or supernatural events like miracles. But I want to ask you, before you leave here, could you explain to me now, why is it you believe that there's predictability in the universe at all? In general now, just why can you use causal analyses when you explain anything? Well, the unbeliever says, well, we've used causal analyses in the past. I mean, the sun has come up every day in the past, just like we predicted. We can tell you the time of sunrise and sunset and so forth. We can give you a causal analysis of that. And causal analyses have been used in the past to build bridges and blah, 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 blah. All these successes in the past. You say, oh, okay, I buy all that. but it's kind of like the Colombo thing. But just one more question before you leave now, please. Just what? Yeah, you have to understand. I really appreciate all that causal analysis in the past, but my question was really about the future. How can you be sure that the causal analyses that you've used in the past are going to apply in the future? Now, I understand why you think it's applied in the past. By the way, you're being very generous when you let them have that. Because if you're going to be a vicious philosopher like Dr. Bonson is paid to be sometimes, you'd say, oh, in other words, we have memory traces of the past that you're relying on, and you have a reason to trust your memory or somebody else's. I mean, we could get pretty nasty, but that wouldn't be very Christian, would it? So we want to... Usually you want to give the unbeliever a lot so that when you do finally, you know, hang him with his own rope, he realizes that you did it charitably. So I say, okay, I really do appreciate all this memory we have of the past and how causal analyses were helpful. But, and I understand that people saw these things and they tested them with their senses and so forth. They observed how the causal analysis allowed for predictability in the past. But I want to know in the future, will this be true? Now, if the reason unbelievers know that causal analyses were legitimate in the past is because they observed it, then you would expect unbelievers to say, well, and we've observed the future, and that's how we know. But, of course, they're not going to fall for that, because if they could observe the future, then there'd be predictive prophecy, and we'd be back to the Babylonian captivity. We'd have to grant the Bible could do that, too. Now, no one has observed the future, Dr. Bonson. Okay. Well, then you are reasoning from the past to the future. I'd like to know on what basis you do that. How can you expect uniformity between previous experience and future experience? To which the answer will be, you love the way unbelievers reason in circles, and yet they accuse us of this. They'll say, well, because it's always been that way in the past. It's always been predictable in the past, and so it'll be predictable in the future. Say, okay, I appreciate that. That's really good. It was predictable in the past. But again, how do you know that even though the future was like the past in the past, that the future will be like the past in the future? Now look, the first lecture was right after lunch. I could understand you having trouble then, okay? Not enough blood to the brain and so forth. But now I don't want to see anybody looking at me like, what's he talking about? Okay, in the past, this podium separates past from future, okay? On this side of the podium... Can I get around? Yeah. Okay. On this side of the podium, this past was analogous to this future. Or if you will, this future was predictable based on this past. Okay? And this future was predictable based on this past. And so when I say, how can you know that the future will be like the past? The person says, it's always been like that in the past. Right? But the question is not that. I agree that in the past the future has been like the past. I want to know whether on this side of the podium the future is going to be like the past. And does the unbeliever have any basis for that? Well, yes, he does, as a matter of fact, but not as an unbeliever. We do have a reason to believe the future will be like the past. And that reason is that we have a sovereign God who created this universe and controls it sovereignly, and he is true to his word, and he has promised that the future will be like the past. In fact, he even built that into the Noahic covenant. You can count on the fact that seed time and harvest will follow each other. God had been governing the universe that way previously as well. You can count on this, that if we are to have dominion in this world, we're to subdue all the world to God's glory, the world is a predictable place. If you learn more about the world, you'll be able to have control over the world, and you can use that to the glory of God. Given a Christian view of the universe, I do expect the sun to rise tomorrow. In fact, I've got promises about that. And the only exception is if Jesus comes, and that's an eschatological issue that we don't want to get into right now. I don't expect he'll be back tomorrow. But if, apart from the hypothesis Jesus comes back tomorrow, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. I know that because I'm a Christian. But now the unbeliever would then have to run to a Christian view of the world and say everything operates in a law-like fashion. And then, having used the Christian worldview to prove the predictability of the natural world, turn around and take the predictability of the natural world to argue against miracles which are found in the Bible, and then say, see, Christianity's not true. And some of you are smiling, so you see what has happened. What I'm getting at is the unbeliever would have to assume a Christian view of the world in order to have a foundation for his argument against the Christian view of the world. His argument is miracles can't happen because there's predictability or causality in this world. But the only way that can be defended, and we're going to do this again later, by the way, when we look at Bertrand Russell, the only way you can defend the predictability of the natural world is to have a Christian view of it. And so how can you then use the predictability of the natural world to argue against miracles and therefore say Christianity is false? Dr. Van Til used the example of a child that was sitting on his father's lap on a train one day, and he saw this child reach up and slap his father in the face. Dr. Van Til said, that's a good analogy of what the unbeliever has to do intellectually. The unbeliever sits on the lap of God, assumes the truth of the Christian worldview, so that he might be in a position to reach up and slap his Heavenly Father's face. You have to first believe the Christian view of the world before you could reason against the Christian view of the world. So here you have another form of arbitrariness when unbelievers have the unargued bias in the case of miracles. Everything operates in a law-like fashion, and so there can't be miracles. The fault here is not that unbelievers have philosophical presuppositions that they bring to the evidence. Please understand, because there are some teachers of apologetics that would tell you, see, what's wrong with the unbelievers? The unbelievers got some assumptions. Well, that's not in itself bad, because everybody has assumptions when they reason. In fact, everybody has fundamental presuppositions. It's not that the unbeliever has presuppositions, it's that the unbeliever could only make sense of his argument by using our presuppositions and then turning around and trying to refute Christianity on the basis of them. All right. Will the argument fly? The first thing on your checklist, you're listening to your roommate or your professor at college, ask yourself about the argument or the alleged argument. Is this mere opinion that's being thrown out at me? In which case, it's worth exactly zero. Is it relativism that's being appealed to? In which case, it's self-contradictory. Is it ignorant conjecture? That is, it just seems to me the text would have to be flawed, or it just seems to me we don't have any evidence for the historical Jesus. Is it unargued bias? The assumption that the universe works in a law-like fashion, even though the unbeliever has no evidence for the universality of causality and so forth. Or if the unbeliever has evidence, it's Christian evidence, and then they turn around and try to use that against the faith, which is self-contradictory. One of the key intellectual sins of people is arbitrariness. The second key intellectual sin is inconsistency. And because I'm out of room on the board, I'm going to erase this much and start over again. As with arbitrariness, there are differences or varieties of inconsistency. That's why you like coming to these lectures. It's like going to 31 flavors, right? We offer you many different things to please you. The kinds of inconsistencies that you are going to look for, first of all, logical fallacies. Another kind of inconsistency you want to be on the lookout for is perhaps best typified by the expression reductio ad absurdum. There's a little bit of Latin we can all learn. You don't even have to know Latin. What does reductio ad absurdum mean? Reduce to absurdity. Okay. If you can take the argument of your opponent and reduce it to absurdity, you have demonstrated an inconsistency in the sense that you assume people will not hold to absurdities. And so since they don't hold to this absurdity, but their argument leads them to this absurdity, they're holding to something that they don't hold to. That's an inconsistency. And then there's the form of inconsistency that can be labeled actions speak louder than words. Thank you. And then finally, a form of inconsistency that I'm going to call presuppositional tension. I cannot give you this afternoon a course in logic. I want to encourage you all to take a course in logic, preferably from a Christian. But even if it's not a Christian, the fact is you're going to learn something about argumentation and how to identify fallacies. You might work through a book on your own. And if I can give a commercial interlude here, you can take a course in critical thinking from the study center where I teach as well. You don't have to come to Southern California to do that, although it would be a lot more pleasant for you if you did, so you could get the sunshine and the surf and so forth. But you can learn logic, you know, from Christian sources, others besides myself. I want to encourage you to do that, because I can't give it all to you this afternoon, but it will be very helpful for you to see the kinds of foibles and mistakes that are made in reasoning, so that when unbelievers do that, you can say, well, your argument's, you know, fallacious, and it's fallacious for this reason. Okay? How about if we say, well, Christianity is not true because, remember the Inquisition? In the Inquisition, people who professed to be Christians did horrible things. They tortured people and they killed people. And so Christianity can't be true. In logic, does anybody know? Can you tell me? What is that fallacy? Anybody heard of the ad hominem fallacy? Arguing against the man rather than against what he believes? Okay, if I had a person in the room right now who is a Marxist. Believe it or not, there are still Marxists around. When I went to Moscow, they weren't very happy with me. I argued with them about Marxist utopianism and economic realities. And they really got burned about that. Now, if I had a Marxist come into this room and tell me, I don't know why a Marxist would say this, so just follow the hypothesis. If I had a Marxist come into the room and tell me, the plan for socialized medicine in this country is not going to work. It's going to prove to actually make it more difficult for people to get medical attention, and certainly more difficult to get competent medical attention. And it won't simply be that the poor suffer, but that everyone will suffer. Now, I don't know why a Marxist would say that, because they would tend to favor socialized medicine, obviously. But if a Marxist did say that, you have to understand it would be totally irrational for me to say, don't believe what he just said, that man's a Marxist. And we all know how bad Marxists are. If I said that, I would be arguing against the man and not against his argument. Likewise, when an unbeliever says, well, I could never be a Christian because I think what you did in the Inquisition was terrible, I would say, me? Pardon me? Excuse me? I wasn't even around when the Inquisition was active. Well, but people who said they were Christians did that. I said, yes, but I want to know whether what they believed was true. And the fact that you don't like the people who profess to be Christians has nothing to do with whether they said this, when they said this or that, it was true or not. That's known as the fallacy of arguing against the man. Now, there are a lot of different versions of ad hominem argument, but I have to resist getting into that because Gary keeps telling me my time's short. You need to know something about logical fallacies so you can point out the inconsistencies in the unbeliever's argument. But beyond logical fallacies, you should especially know the technique of reasoning that I have labeled reductio ad absurdum, reducing your opponent to absurdity. Reductio ad absurdum rests upon a particular law of logic that says whatever implies that which is false is itself false. About that again? Whatever implies what is false is itself false. And I'm afraid in the short time that I have, I was going to explain to you why that has to be, but maybe you just have to take it on my authority right now. If some premise or some position implies a false premise, the original premise is false as well. If it really does imply that, then the original premise must also be false. And so, that being the case, if you can reduce your opponent's position to something which is false, or known to be false, that is, reduce it to an absurdity, then you have refuted the position of your opponent. This is what's known in debate as reductio ad absurdum. I'm going to take what you believe and ring the logical changes on it. I'm going to show that it leads to another position, a position which we all know to be false. Let me give you an example. First premise, if there are no universal moral principles, then it is invalid for one culture to condemn the activities of another culture. The position that I've just stated is known as cultural relativism. It is not right for 20th century Americans to condemn any other culture because all ethics is relative to the society in which you live. If there are no universal moral principles, then it is invalid for one culture to condemn the activities of another culture. William Graham Sumner once wrote, he thought he was very clever, that if there is a law of God that applies to all mankind, God has been suspiciously secretive about it. Which is his way of snidely saying, which you take to be God's universal law. Isn't it interesting that the Samoans didn't hear about it? God only told Americans about it, or whatever it may be. The cultural relativist says, if there are no universal moral principles, then it's invalid for one culture to condemn the activities of another culture. And what gives at least minimal credibility to the cultural relativist when you hear that presented in class is that then the cultural relativist will go on and seem to live in terms of that. We'll say, it's wrong. The famous example in our generation is Margaret Mead's work with the sexual practices of unmarried Samoan girls. And she came to the conclusion, which, by the way, was later pretty much demolished in terms of its historical factuality by another researcher or sociologist, but nevertheless, she came to the conclusion that since these Samoan young girls don't practice the kind of chastity that is taught in America for unmarried young ladies, that therefore all moral values are relative. Well, there's some huge leaps of logic that are there. But my point is, that's the sort of thing people will bring up. They'll say, different cultures have different standards for marriage or for private property or for life, whatever. You know, we all know that Eskimos send their, you know, invalid, which is to say their invalid parents, on ice floats out to sea and let them die and so forth. And so it turns out that from culture to culture, you have different moral standards. So you hear those kind of examples, and people will think, oh, okay, well, then the person's willing to live in terms of his premise. There are no universal moral absolutes, and so one culture cannot condemn another culture. But then you have to learn to bring up the counterexamples that are not so easy for the cultural relativists. You say, well, then I guess it would be wrong for us to condemn Hitler's Germany, right? The Nazi atrocities were fairly true to the Nazi philosophy of life. So in that culture, it's perfectly all right. Or if you really want to step on toes, I'd suggest you try this one. Well, then Martin Luther King Jr. was certainly out of his place to try to reform American culture, wasn't he? Because the absolutes of any culture give us our moral standards, and he was trying to criticize the absolutes of racist American culture, or at least what he took to be racist American culture. The irony is that cultural relativism doesn't allow you to criticize it. And yet cultural relativists will turn right around and do what? They'll criticize racism, they'll criticize Hitler, they'll criticize Idi Amin, they'll criticize the genocide of the Jews, they'll criticize the practice in India of a widow being burned on the funeral pyre of her husband, and on and on and on and on. They'll say, this is horrible. These sorts of things shouldn't happen. We've got to change the world. But if you're a cultural relativist, you have no reason to change the world because everything's relative. So here's the reductio ad absurdum. What did I say the first premise was? If there are no universal moral principles, then it's invalid for one culture to condemn the activities of another culture. That is, relativism implies something that you know is not true. It implies that you shouldn't condemn a Hitler. You shouldn't condemn racism. You shouldn't condemn any number of these atrocities that might be brought up. And since relativism implies what is known to be false, then relativism itself is false because it's been reduced to absurdity. You reduce relativism to absurdity by taking it, wringing the logical changes on it, taking it to its consequences, and showing that no one's willing to accept those consequences. They may appear to, but once you bring up the right illustrations, they say, oh no, we don't believe that. So you've reduced relativism to absurdity and therefore shown that the relativist is inconsistent. Now, why is inconsistency such a bad thing? Well, sometimes I'm tempted to tell people, if you accept inconsistency, what's so bad about that is that people can get into an argument and say, yes, it is, no, it isn't, yes, it is, no, it isn't, and that's all you'll ever have. You can accept both of them. Because inconsistencies are acceptable, it can be yes, it is, and no, it isn't at the same time. But then not everyone understands what I'm getting at, and so I have to point out that inconsistencies are unacceptable because from an inconsistency, you can believe anything. Maybe when I have more time tomorrow, I can put a little argument on the board to show how that is. From P and not P, I can prove anything. Anything. In fact, I'll level this challenge. Somebody write down on a piece of paper something you think that I cannot prove. And I'll show you. I can prove anything from an inconsistency. And that's why in intellectual circles, if you're trying to be rational, you cannot accept inconsistencies. Logical fallacies, reductio ad absurdums. Another kind of inconsistency can be called the actions speak louder than words fallacy. I'm making that up, but it'll help you remember it. Actions speak louder than words. It is not a mark of rationality for a person to assert one thing and then live contrary to that assertion. That might be considered a kind of moral hypocrisy, but equally it can be seen as a kind of irrationality. There's an inconsistency or tension within the reasoning of the unbeliever. Because the unbeliever has one belief that he's using when he linguistically asserts his position, but then he has a conflicting belief evident when he behaves in a way contrary to what he asserted previously. So when people live contrary to what they say, they are being moral hypocrites, but they're also being irrational. They have an inconsistency in what they believe or what is evident about their beliefs. And the life of the unbeliever, it turns out, is riddled with just such inconsistencies. Let me give you some examples quickly. An unbeliever will presuppose human dignity and attend the funeral of a dead friend, honor a relative who has passed away. And yet, at the same time, the unbeliever is known to have argued previously that man is, in principle, no different from any other product of evolution, like a horse or a dog. Now, social events like funerals or solemn events where Christians don't want to make asses of themselves by doing this, but hypothetically, I've often thought when I've gone to a funeral, especially when unbelievers are going through all this stuff about human dignity and so forth and so on, how wonderful this person is, I say, what are we doing here at this funeral? We don't have funerals for dogs. Well, some people in Southern California do, but they're considered weirdos. We don't have funerals for horses, for aardvarks and cockroaches. Why are we having a funeral for this particular part of the evolutionary chain? See, on the one hand, the unbeliever says man is nothing but advanced protoplasm, just the slime that's evolved. And yet he doesn't treat him like slime or her like slime when the death takes place. It's a kind of irrationality. The unbeliever will insist that man is nothing more than a complex of biochemical factors that are controlled by the laws of physics. And then the unbeliever who has argued all day that way in the science lab or in the lecture hall at the university goes home and kisses his wife and children and says he loves them. Man is nothing more than chemical reactions controlled by the laws of physics, and yet he acts like there's something more, something above biochemical responses when he kisses his wife and says he loves her. The unbeliever will argue that in sexual relations, anything goes. There are no moral absolutes. I heard that so often when I was a college student during the sexual revolution. And then the same unbeliever who says anything goes will turn around and condemn the war in Vietnam as an absolute moral atrocity. Excuse me? Isn't there something wrong with this argument? When it comes to shacking up with my girlfriend, anything goes. When it comes to the United States getting its pleasure by beating up South Vietnamese, that's not okay. Once you say anything goes, guess what? Anything goes. You can't turn around and be a moral absolutist then. The unbeliever will indignantly condemn child molesters, even though he said you can get your sexual pleasure any way you wish. Well, of course, I think child molestation is horrible. I think it's a capital offense. There's no doubt about my negativity about it, but I can make sense of what I'm saying when I condemn child molestation. The unbeliever cannot. What you have in the case of the unbeliever is somebody who says one thing with his words, but his actions betray it. Actions speak louder than words. That's another kind of inconsistency we wish to point out. And when we come back after our question and answer period now and tomorrow for the next lecture, I'll talk about presuppositional tensions you should look for in the arguments of unbelievers. Remember, just by way of review, when you hear the unbeliever argue, you want to do a checklist. You want to ask, first, is he being arbitrary? Secondly, is he being inconsistent? Thirdly, what are the consequences of this argument? And then fourthly, what are the preconditions of intelligibility for this argument?